accession number 237879.
Major Dillon, Reel 9. Now, before we go on, there's a bit, since I last saw you, there's something you've remembered that you want to go in, which is about the Sacred Company. Which, if you could set the scene and take us through this.
After the Benghazi debacle, the regiment reformed at Cabrit, where we were engaged in training and recruiting, as we had quite a number of casualties on the raid. Out of the blue appeared a strange body of Greeks who'd escaped from the now occupied Greece, which in those days was a very difficult thing to do. They were all rather above average sort of young men. They were under the command of a Colonel Kerlinski, who became a general later and commanded the Greek special services, who was a great character. These men were following the ancient Greek tradition that when your country is overrun, it is your duty to escape to a friendly country, reform yourselves into a body of men, and you call yourself the Sacred Squadron or Company. This is what they were. I, for whatever reason, I suppose I was a yachtsman, was given the job of instructing the men in amphibious warfare, as they thought it would be a good idea since they were Greeks. They would join George Jellicoe's about to be formed special boat service, whose mission was to raid the Greek islands. And since they were Greeks and a lot of them were sailors, it might be quite a good thing. I found it very difficult not being able to speak Greek and knowing nothing about Greeks in those days. I was not achieving very much, but my bacon was saved by the help of a very smooth Greek officer who, for some reason, was living in our mess, who I up until then thought was British, because he spoke immaculate British, and his uniform had obviously been made by Guise. And he said at lunchtime one day, "You seem to be having a bit of trouble, old boy, with those chaps. What are you trying to teach them to do?" And I said, "I'm trying to teach them to row a boat." Oh, he said, "Perhaps you should leave that to me. You've had a very good lunch and a couple of gins. Come down to the quay about 5 o'clock because the bus to Cairo goes at 5:30. They'll want to catch that." He took them up to the end of the Bitter Lake, towed them up in a motorboat and said, "Gentlemen, I'm leaving you here. It's 12 miles back to the quay. The bus leaves in an hour and a half." I went down the quay, having had a good kip. They came in like Oxford and Cambridge rowing. The biggest, toughest Greek had taken charge and thumped the others. They were rowing like mad. He said, "The job's done. We Greeks have a different way of doing things from you." And that, in fact, was the start of the Greek Sacred Squadron, which eventually became part of George Jellicoe's special boat service, and is the foundation of the extant, still continuing, Greek special forces and commandos that still exist to this day and owe their origins to that time. That's it.
Right, now, getting back to the story, so to speak, you just got back in around about January 1945, and you'd been debriefed, psychoanalysed.
Yeah.
What happened next?
Came home to England, eventually.
How long did it take?
Oh, we came on a troop ship, I can't remember. I can't even remember the name of the ship. And eventually rejoined my regiment in Germany.
Which?
The first standard in...
At what time? I mean, was this before the war had ended, or...?
The war had ended by then. At a place called Neuhaus, Paderborn.
How do you spell that? Sorry.
Paderborn, P... or Neuhaus. Neuhaus is N-E-U-H-A-U-S. Paderborn, P-A-D-E-R-B-O-R-N. Where we were the demonstration battalion for the School of Infantry. You have the history of the very distinguished 1st Battalion. I felt rather humble joining all these great warriors, like Jack Dye, for instance.
And what was your impression of the 1st Battalion? I mean, you were obviously a bit overawed, but who stood out in your mind at the time?
Well, for instance, company commanders of the calibre of Jack Dye.
What was he like, Jack Dye, then, as a company? I mean, I know he's a major general.
As a brother officer, I got to know him very well, and he was obviously very good. He knew I. My trouble was I was totally obsolete, having been in special forces. I mean, for instance, the phonetic alphabet had been changed whilst I was. I didn't even know what it was, the new one. They thought it would be too difficult to teach us that sort of thing. So I was totally obsolete. I'd had a totally different experience. And there's an awful lot from the likes of Jack Dyer, who'd been right through the thing, which I had not. And I'll epitomise Jack Dyer like this. He was a platoon commander and company commander, and well decorated. And I said, "What is your proudest memory, Jack?" He said, "I was wounded 3 times on the battlefield and 3 times went back." That's my impression of Jack Dyer.
Any other characters that stood out?
Well, Peter Barclay had gone by then. Humphrey Wilson, who was second in command.
What was he like?
He was a senior subaltern when I joined. He was still there. And his cry was, despite rain or shellfire, he was absolutely grand old boy. And he went right through the war with Jack, commanding a company. And Jack was quite convinced, and Humphrey thought we were still in India, because he kept saying, "What was the name of the groom that I had for my polo ponies?" He said, "Shot and shell seemed to mean nothing to Humphrey." He was totally unimpressed. And I do remember this one. Humphrey walked into the mess at Neuhaus and said, "Bottle of champagne." And the mess sergeant brought him a chit to sight. He said, "What? Do you mean we're..." "Well, sir, the free champagne's finished. We're paying for..." He said, "What? I'm off. Put in for a posting." Left. He said, "I've done made my contribution to this war. I'm going somewhere else." It was like that.
Who was a colonel?
Peter Barclay gone. There was a chap called Trixie Cubitt joined. I don't think this really ought to be recorded.
Okay, right.
In that he was a very gallant officer who'd been a Jap prisoner. And even more than I was totally out of context and suddenly put in command of a crack Rhine Army battalion. He'd had domestic troubles, he had and this Jap experience. He realised that he was professionally incompetent. He started drinking and so on, and he was relieved. And it was the War Office at its worst. He should have been sent on a course. He should have been allowed to recover. And I was very fond of him. To the day he died, we used to keep in touch. But he was a broken man after that. That's what the army does to people sometimes. Gets it wrong.
Any other officers you remember stand out?
A number of National Service officers. Jimmy Perry Warnes. Tony Ferrier was adjutant, who was still alive, who again had been a Jap prisoner, but he hacked it being adjutant. He was all right. There were an awful lot of National Service officers still there whose names I can't really...
Now, what did you think of National Service officers? I mean, you were in a regular battalion.
Yes,
How did they fit in?
At that stage, bearing in mind my rather checkered background, I'd had no experience of a National Service officer. And the ones that I met, they were a very mixed bunch, from very good to rather indifferent. But on the whole, later on I met a lot more National Service and Territorial officers, first class, with very few exceptions.
Now, how did you fit back into the regiment? I mean, you've been away so long.
I suppose I was sufficiently arrogant to assume that I could skate on thin ice.
What do you mean by that?
In that I hadn't appreciated how out of touch I was with the modern regular army, which meant I made a cock of the staff college, which I should have sailed through, but I didn't.
Now, when did you go to staff college?
Before I went. I went there and was kicked out. I don't mind admitting that.
You went there in 45?
Yeah. And...
What went wrong with staff college?
Well, I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. I was still talking a different phonetic language, and my warfare, this whole Rhine Army concept of guns and artillery, and all I can remember in the desert, you hadn't got any bloody guns, and you hadn't got many tanks. You just effing well had to do it, and I was totally, totally at loggerheads. And they said, "Dylan, it won't do," and that was that. I have to admit, if you like, senior officers should not have sent me there. I should have regrouped, as it were. I should have stayed and done courses.
So you should have gone to the
Norfolks first and done company commander's courses and worked up. But that's with hindsight. I was out of my depth. I was talking a totally different language. I'd fought a totally different war from the average Rhine Army company commander.
Well, which staff was it?
Camberley.
It was at Camberley.
Yeah. And I have to admit that I was totally out of my depth. They were quite right to get rid of me.
How long did you last? I mean,
about halfway through the thing, they said, "Look here, old boy, we think you should go back to the regiment," which I did. So and then went back.
Were you back to the regiment in 45?
Yes, that's when I went back to Germany.
It would still be in 45, yes, though, late 45.
Late 45. And then, now...
So, how about some of any NCOs stand out?
The drum major, Jessop, was a great character. Because when we got to Berlin, which was after... We went from Neuhaus and Paderborn to Berlin as the garrison. The only way to do training from Berlin, you had to leave all your vehicles behind. You got in a train and went out to the battle area, did your training, and you left a rear party behind. For instance, you didn't bring the officer's mess or the CO's staff car. And there's a classic regimental story. The battalion was away. The mess sergeant remained. The CO's staff car was there. And Jessop, who was a great ladies' man, held what was known as Jessop's guest night. He invited a whole crowd of Fräuleins in. He sent the CO staff car around to pick them up. He had the regimental silver on the table. Charlie, the German head waiter, doing mess sergeant. The biggest piss up out. But nobody was there. The cat was away, you see. The only trouble was the CO's driver taking these Fräuleins home was absolutely pixelated out of his mind, managed to turn the staff car upside down, and there was a court of inquiry, wasn't there? And it's Regimental History Sergeant Jessop's guest night, which I do remember quite vividly.
You were away, obviously.
I was away, we were on a...
How did you fit in with the training?
Oh, by then I was catching up. I mean, I went on a course at Paderborn, the School of Infantry, where at that time Bob Turner Kane was commanding by now. He had been chief instructor. I'd done the course there. I'd by now a competent infantry officer again. I felt quite confident I could command a battalion.
What was it you had to learn? You know, the
procedures. Battle procedures, which, when we went to war, it was very sort of, come on, chaps, follow me. Not much more than that. Battle drills. So and this whole thing, the phonetic alphabet, you felt a bloody fool. You were talking another language, literally. Anyway, that was that. Then what happened?
How did you get on with the Germans?
Well, with Miriam being a German speaker, we had to be very careful. But, for instance, shooting was a great thing, game shooting. The Germans weren't allowed to have guns during the war. There'd been no game shooting, so game was rampant everywhere. And for sport, what we used to do is go to the Schloss, the castle, and tell the landowner that eight officers were coming to shoot on Saturday morning, that he was to provide 25 beaters, that he would be allowed to come out with the guns. We would bring the food and the drink, but he was to supply the plate and the silver. It was so. And it seemed to work all right. The spoils of war. And on the sort of serious side of, which the soldiers loved, there was very careful rationing in Germany, as you can imagine. There was very short of food. And there was control of animal movement. Particularly pigs, because the Germans love sausages and pigs. And you're always taking stock of the livestock on a farm. And the soldiers, because they're all little old Swedes from Norfolk. You go to a farm and count the pigs, like there's 250 pigs. You had a list which said 250 pigs, and you signed it, 250 pigs. You go to the next farm, which said there should be 180 pigs. There were 180 pigs. But your corporal said, I've seen that pig before this morning. They used to move them around because they knew you could. The soldiers loved that, of course. Because being all farm boys, I've seen that pig before this morning. So that was that sort of thing. And then we got to Berlin, was another thing altogether.
Now, what was it like in Berlin?
Drink was the trouble.
In what way?
In that a bottle of Steinhager gin was 2 shillings. Now, we'd won a war. One has to realise people were, I don't know what they call it, post-traumatic shock, what they call it. All of us, in our different ways, had been at war for 5 years. It was suddenly all over, and there's a bottle of gin on the table which cost nothing. And drink was the problem, no doubt about it.
For you as well?
Well, I suppose all of us, we undoubtedly drank too much. I mean, I didn't get myself into trouble, but there was a lot of trouble from drink with Rhine Army at that time. And then with soldiers, there was a lot of VD as well. But, I mean, that's general history.
And the men, they wouldn't drink gin, would they? What were they drinking?
They drink beer.
And was that equally cheap?
Very cheap. All liquor was cheap. And the black market economy, you were told, if you do engage in black market, you're destroying the German economy. Well, our sort of rationale was, I've been paid for the last 5 years to destroy the German economy. Why should I stop now? For instance, what was it? A packet of cigarettes would produce 1 cigarette. I remember going to the officers' club, which was the staff was German, saying a bottle of champagne and holding out 1 cigarette, and the waiter grabbed it. The cigarette economy was worse far, because the mark was still the Deutschmark until they brought in the what do they call the damn thing, the euro money. It was new money, and overnight it sort of reformed. But for instance, black market, we all bought Volkswagens. You could buy a Volkswagen from the NAFI for £100, and you didn't service a Volkswagen. You put a new engine in every now and again. That cost 1 tin of coffee and took 45 minutes. It was that sort of, you know, kind of crazy economy.
Did some people take advantage of it to make money as opposed to just have a slightly more comfortable life?
I did a black market, 2 black market things. I had an old Lagonda motor car which I'd bought for about £200. A friend of mine brought it out to Germany, had it in Berlin. It was the only Lagonda motor car, as far as I know, in Germany, which was rather fine. The engine was very worn out. I found in Berlin a garage, the proprietor of which had been the Lagonda and Bentley agent before the war. He'd got a 6-litre Bentley walled up in the back of his garage, which I was seriously tempted to buy, but he said, no, leave that, I want this, my asset. He said, your engine needs new pistons, your engine needs rebuilding. I said, and how much? He said, well, two bottles of gins and six cans of coffee, done. Then I had the bodywork redone by Mr. Habemuller in Dusseldorf, who was a bodybuilder. And I said to both these chefs, you can do what you like, provided you don't remove the chassis or engine numbers. At the end of the story, we got back to Harwich, the customs officer, and said, what's the date of that car? And I said, it's 1933. And they said, it looks remarkably smart. So I said, well, it's very well looked after. And they looked and couldn't find any. Go on, sir. Good, best of luck. That was the sort of thing. I don't mind admitting to that.
But there were some people making more.
There were some people making.
You don't want to talk about that, don't you?
Well, I don't know specifically, but undoubtedly a lot of people did make a lot of money. Undoubtedly.
What was morale like in the Norfolks, the 1st Battalion, would
you
say?
Oh, high. High on the whole. First Battalion reckoned they were the crack battalion in the Rhino. They were. And we won nearly everything. The Rhine Army boxing. Have you heard the name Tim Creasy? General who died. Was in that battalion. He was assistant adjutant. This is when we were in Berlin. And the Provost Sergeant Wackett, who Jack Dye will remember this, Sergeant Wackett was a very tough athlete. But the men always said he had a yellow streak because during the campaign, he was with the battalion and I wasn't there, he was always absent. He was hated by the men, as most Provost Sergeants were. Creasy, as assistant adjutant, didn't like Wackett, although he had to put up with it. And he said one night, I'm going to humble Sergeant Wackett. I'm going in for the army boxing. And I remember saying to Tim in the West, you're not a boxer. You're a good cricketer, you're a good hockey player. You never. No, he said, boxing is easy. You just get fit and hit the other bugger right out of the ring. I said, what? Well, he did. He got fit. He went right through to the finals, which happened in the Nuremberg Ring in Berlin. Wackett had got into the final. In the semi-finals, Wackett had broken the RAF champion's jaw in three places, so he wasn't a duffer. And there they were, it was a match at night, and Tim had his dinner, had a large whiskey, and said, see you all down the ring, chaps. We went down, apparently Tim went into Wackett's dressing room and said, by my watch, Wackett, you've got 3 minutes of life left, make the best of it. And then in front, there must have been about 20, 30,000 soldiers there, actually, all the floodlights. Tim got in the ring and he very nearly killed Wackett. Teeth all over the road, blood everywhere. He just smashed him into the canvas. With no sounds whatsoever, but brute strength. He said, that's all you do, boy. You just smash the other fellow down. And he said, ever afterwards, Wackett followed him around like a dog. That's a bit of regimental history which Jack Dye will confirm.
Any other stories you remember from Berlin? You know, does that sort of story give us a spirit to the North?
Spirit of the Norks. The equipment repairer. Every regiment used to have an equipment repairer. He was like a saddle maker, like he could stitch canvas, and he was the equipment repairer. He was a poacher. And he got his gun. We'd all got shotguns. He thought, well, in that Berlin, there won't be any game. He said, do you know what? One night, I heard a pheasant go up to perk in the park, you know, perk. I said, I'm going to have that. What's more, I got it. I reckon I got the last pheasant in Berlin. So that was another one. That was another Berlin story. I heard they got the perk, he said, so I went and got it.
What about, how did you get on with the Russians, the Soviet, you know?
Yes, I tell you how I got it. I was in command of called the Tiergarten Company, which was on. Our next neighbour was the Russian, was the border, and I was adjacent to my Russian opposite number, and there was continual trouble at night. There were all these cafes and brothels and God. I mean, there was very little law and order, and soldiers would go missing. And I had a Polish interpreter who spoke Russian, ring up my Russian officer number and say, I've lost a soldier. We think he may have strayed over into your place. Can you send him back if you find him? What rank is he? I said, well, he's a Lance Corporal. Oh, we don't bother about Lance Corporals. I said, what do you mean? He said, oh, we just chuck him in the river. Because I would ring up and say, I found one of your chaps. What rank is he? If he's below the rank of soldier, I don't want him back. That was a kind of. We were on those sort of terms with the Russians.
Didn't sound like it was too bad.
No, we were allies, and we could go into the Russian section, go to the ballet and the opera, beautiful. We were free to go into all the sectors, and for instance, you'd go out to the Russian ballet, the opera. No, it was the opera. Then you go to the French sector, to the French officers' club for dinner. Then you go to the British officers' club for a booze up. Then it was time to go home to bed. So it was a bit of a piss up. And our other function in Berlin, which I very nearly forgot, was the guarding of the war criminals in, what the hell's the name of the barracks?
Spandau Barracks.
Spandau Barracks. And we each did a turn. I was OC, the garrison, the guard for.
How exactly did that work?
Well, we had virtually no contact with the prisoners. We were just a perimeter guard, and we patrolled the area, and we could observe them at exercise. So we never spoke to any of them. And we changed. I think it was a month ago. We changed the Americans and the Russians and the French. We changed around every month. Totally impersonal.
So you didn't see.
Didn't see.
Were you aware of who was in there?
Yes, we knew who was in there, but it meant very little.
What were you guarding against? I mean, who did you think might attack? Was there any idea of?
There might have been an attempt to escape or help them escape. I suppose. I think it was largely symbolic.
And what was the mood of the German people? I mean, how did they treat you? Were they friendly, unfriendly? I mean, generally, in the street and around?
I know a bit about the German, having been in a German-occupied country. The difference, if they're in occupation, as they were in Greece, they're totally arrogant, brutal and cruel. When you're in occupation, they're so subservient and sniveling, it makes you sick. Maybe that's my opinion of the German race.
So you didn't like them?
No, I do not like, to this day, I do not like Germans, I'm afraid. I spent nearly 2 years under German occupation. I've never yet heard a German admit he knew anything about it or apologise. That's my opinion. I'm prepared to.
Now, before we go any further, you want to make clear that this actually isn't 1945 and that you had another posting to 4th Battalion. North,
yes, before Britain, going to Germany.
After you'd failed the Staff College.
I went to the 4th Battalion, not the 1st. I went to the 4th Battalion, was reforming at Wyndham outside Norwich.
And what were your impressions of the reform? What sort of battalion was it?
It was very strong. It consisted of people from all over the place, different regiments, some Norfolks, a lot of ex-commandos, all sorts, about 800 strong.
This would be 1945. Is it before or after the end of the war?
After the end of the war.
And
Dick Freeman Taylor was the CO. And we were expecting to go to Germany. And I walked into the mess one day, and he held up a telegram and said, "Look what this says, oh boy. It says, for Germany, read Greece." He knew me. He said, "You know something about Greece?" I said, "Yes." I said, "Right, OC Advance Party." And away I went, and we ended up in Patras, which is in the western Peloponnese. It suited me. I was thrilled.
And what did you have to do as the Advance Party?
Well, to reconnoitre the barracks and find out, you know, the usual thing, to be there in advance of the regiment. And we took over in Patras, and we had a detached company of all places on Corfu. And it was glorious. At that time, it was just after the war, one realised, well, having been there quite not very long before, there was no law and order whatsoever. The police force hadn't been established. Government was very sketchy. The law and order was the 4th Battalion of the Royal Norfolk Regiment, virtually.